Ho, ho, ho. That's right, it's nearly Christmas. This episode of The Big Jim Show is brought to you by Maul and Brawl. Maul and Brawl is a men's skin and beard care range founded by yours truly. It's been tried and tested by me with a smooth, deep scent of dark honey and tobacco. We'll have you smelling musky and back ready to Maul and Brawl again in no time. You can order the Caveman Pack, which is the shower gel, moisturiser and beard oil. The Modern Man Pack, which is the shower gel and moisturiser. Or you can be stingy and just buy one off. I'm only messing. Your custom is well received. Whether or not you're mauling in the office or brawling in the streets, Maul and Brawl is for you. Just head to maulandbrawl.com and use the code RugbyPod or BigJim10 and that'll give you a lovely 10% off. That's maulandbrawl.com with the code RugbyPod or BigJim10. Maul and Brawl, for men that maul.
Big Jim is wearing his heels, marching around the town to get some thrills, but it's time to go in now, and he's big.
On this episode, I'm joined by a former teammate of mine. I coached the man. Nothing to do with me. It's the great, the wonderful Ben Earl. I showed him some whiskey and he shoot it like a ball. Yeah, so I am doing this Pitchard show. It's called The Big Jim Show. I should have never have called it this. I should have called it something less egotistical with it. Do you think, is that a thing as players? We're into it, by the way.
Yeah.
I do wonder. I haven't really asked, not that I need feedback from players, but I am seeing you guys as the most important part of rugby. You are the most important part.
It's definitely, like, when we saw Mbappe, it was at one of the games with a couple of French boys. I was like, that is just, as well, it's awesome. Like, people that we watch and deify and go, God, he's the best in his class and whatever he's doing. Like, see those guys supporting the game is only going to be good for us. And yeah, the fact that, like, Javier Bardem, I actually watched him like 2 days before
so
in
cool.
No Country for Old Men, and then there. I'm like, that is.
But I'm there
awesome.
With him, and it was crazy. And the thing is, with it, I not once did I second guess myself. Like, they gave me, and I say this, a World Rugby Pass came together.
Yeah.
And they kind of said to me, like, if you had a blank canvas. And the World Cup's now, like, what do you want to do? And it's like, well, you can do a podcast, you can do this, you can do that. And I said, let's try and do something that hasn't been done, that other sports are doing, and Formula One, the circus that follows Formula One round.
The starting thing.
Where Martin Brundle doesn't know anyone's names. Yeah. It's quite hilarious. But I just said, like, I know that there's celebrities and other sports and genres and entertainment industry that love rugby. Why don't we bring them into our world for the first time?
Yeah.
And there was loads of pushback, and it was like, we had Rita Ora on the pitch with Taika Waititi for the final, and I could see people, oh no, what they're doing. I was like, this is gold. This is like brilliant.
Yeah, people love that.
I do wonder with the players though.
Anyone talking about rugby is a good thing at the moment with us, because obviously there's still a bit of grey stuff going around financially, but it does feel like since the World Cup, there's a bit more feel good around the sport, a bit more competition. Obviously the league itself is great in the bigger picture. Now you've got a higher concentration of top class players, having lost now three teams. You know, you kind of, all the best players are now playing, best young English players anyway, are playing against each other every week, which can only be good.
Like,
the fact that you've got Juan Martin Gonzalez starting seven for Argentina going against Tom Pearson, who's, like, you know, trying to get into the team, and then you've got Courtney, who's played however many times for England. Like, those three going against each other is just awesome. Like,
I don't think we celebrate rugby enough. Like, someone said to me in the street, you're just a media hype guy. Like, naturally I am. Like, I am a hype guy, but I look at all the other sports and we talk about NFL, and I'm big into this New Heights podcast where Kelce brothers do.
Yeah.
And the way they talk about their sport and the way that you hear other people interacting, because they've got issues as well, like the same issues as rugby. I know they're a much bigger entity, but they love it. Like, everything's positive. It's high energy. No one's getting slagged. No one's talking about all the bad bits. And there's bad bits of everything. There's bad bits of life. Like, you can go and find it. It's
everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's probably more prominent than the hype man and the positivity.
Yeah.
I just don't think we do enough our sport to just really celebrate that this chaos and this energy and this testosterone-fueled, violent sport I just don't feel we're doing it. I feel it's like we're just apologising or everything's a bit like, oh, I know, can't say.
There is definitely a bit of that. I think as well is that we've had a chat with like Lucy, our CEO, got us in a lot of the younger guys who they think are going to be, you know, moving forward with the team for the next couple of years, and saying like, look, guys, we want to grow you. We want to grow the club. And I think the first thing we said was actually like, we've got to be willing to put our necks on the line a little bit, and not everything's going to land. Not everything's going to be really successful, but like, the more content we're producing as a team, as a squad, like being a bit braver with putting stuff out there. I mean, Sari's put that mental video with me and Max and doing that Budweiser advert. Like, I didn't know like if it was going to go any good. Some people hated it, some people loved it, but people are watching it. Like, and they have an opinion. And I think that's kind of the premise of, I think, a lot of the younger players now. We've got a bit of a burden, you know, trying to almost make the sport trendy again, in the sense that we've got to get ourselves out there. We've got to be doing some pretty crazy stuff, because the sport itself is inherently nuts anyway. Like, it's as gladiatorial as it gets nowadays, isn't it? So I think we've got to be brave and probably do a bit more than maybe some who are going or have gone in the past.
Yeah, that's wicked that Lucy Ray is doing that. I've had conversations with Lucy, and as I say, I've been kind of putting myself out there for the last 7 years. And I think we can now see real value with you youngsters coming through, you young lads, that you see that value, because it isn't just all about the team now. And as maybe difficult it is as a player to say that as an individual, but you have to build your own brand, which then builds the brand of the team that Ben Earl or Farrell or Itoje, these big names now in English rugby, which then grows the game. Like, I know it's quite an easy thing to say, but you young lads are now putting yourselves out there. It's great that you see value in that.
Definitely. I think the what sums it up for me is the best is the fact that like Saracens have the most followers, I think still do maybe, or second most in the league. There's no coincidence that we have probably the two most marketable players in the league in Owen and Marrow. So, you know, some people probably follow Marrow and then by association follow Saracens. So that's, you know, if we can get every player gets 1,000 people doing that, all of a sudden that's a lot of traction on Saracens, a lot of traction individually. So that's kind of where I think we've got to go to.
Yeah, because everyone speaks about this, need to grow the game, need to showcase the characters, everyone says about this. I don't necessarily think it's like you need to showcase the characters, like you need to be a character, you need to be funny, to be charismatic. I think you can just be yourself, like, as in we have a sport of the greatest athletes walking the planet. One of the most difficult games to play. It's a difficult game to consume as a fan sometimes because of the laws. But the athleticism and the stuff that goes in, week out, to get the output on the pitch, that's selling in itself. I saw something with Ellis Jenkins, the Cardiff back runner. Yeah. He was mic'd up.
That was brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah, I love that.
A little thing like that was so cool. That interaction of a current athlete, an international,
willing to have everything he said on a pitch mic'd up. I think that's golden. And again, exactly, so if someone asked me to do that right now, I'd probably have a bit of hesitation, but that's the kind of stuff we exactly should be doing. Maybe we won't be as forthcoming with stuff like that, because you know there is quite a lot of feedback flying around when you do stuff like that in rugby at the moment, but we've definitely got to be a bit braver.
Yeah, that's great that you are receptive to that. What's the general consensus then, like as a group? And we're diving straight into it, because it's kind of mixed. Like, you listen to people like you speak, chatting to Lucy Ray, chatting to the Natal Sharks chief of brand officer about what they can do. And like, I'm having these conversations because I've kind of done it on a whim and winging it. But what are the conversations like internally with the lads? Because you mentioned like Faz and Marrow, and you look at the England team, they're quite closed off. Ireland's exactly the same. Like, we had Andrew Porter on the rugby pod, but apart from that, you don't really get access. What's the general consensus of rugby players and athletes? Is it a bit old school and new school? Like, is it spoken about? Is it a thing? Or is it kind of just organically you feel potentially going to come out?
I think there's two sides to it. So I think a really good example of it done well is the England 0-2 inside line. Like, I think I enjoy watching that, and I'm involved in the camps because I see even stuff that I'm not privy to. And I think that kind of access is brilliant. I think what we as players need to understand as well is that, like, when people are filming, they're not out to get us. They're not out to catch us out and say something, because we said something about an opposition player. They caught us saying something about another person who's not in the camp. Everyone wants to create the best content, and sometimes the best content, there is some controversial moments, and but at the end of the day, as long as we keep editorial, as long as we keep the rights of what's going out, boys are going to be a lot more forthcoming as well. And I think there has been times in the past where, you know, maybe people have been stung and a bit more hesitant to do that stuff. But, you know, as long as we're all open and saying, look, we all want to get the best content out there. What makes the best content? The stuff people don't see. You know, everyone watches a game of rugby, everyone watches a bit of warm up, but they don't see the meetings. They don't see us getting physio. They don't see us, you know, having unit sessions where, you know, we're mauling and scrumming. Like, people just don't see that because there isn't any of that out there, really. So that's the stuff that we need to be pushing a bit more, and behind the scenes stuff always sells a bit better, I think.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I think, like, now more than ever, and we've seen the stuff with Faz, the scrutiny that youth players, especially English players, mm-hmm. are under now is higher than it's ever been.
Yeah,
I don't know the reason behind that, but it must be really interesting as a young man coming to that situation. You're going to a World Cup, biggest stage of any player's career, most viewed World Cup in history. You make a semi-final. Yeah, you're under this kind of weird scrutiny as a team. I know we're diving straight into it, but maybe that it's almost like the irony is you probably don't want to say anything, or you've got the lads don't want to do anything because you're getting fucking rinsed by the media on one hand, yet you're being asked to put yourself out there into the media on the other. Like, how, not tough has it been, but like, what's that space
it's
like?
It's definitely an interesting space. It's an interesting topic of discussion. I think we had a really interesting meeting with the RPA the other week, talking a little bit about, you know, the Team England moving forward. And there's quite a good bit of interest, I think, to try this Netflix series around the Six Nations or a coming tour or something. So that'll be really interesting. But I think on that note, like, yeah, it was an interesting World Cup in that regard, because probably the narrative around the team until the kickoff of the first game was England aren't going to get out of the group, which we, you know, we tapped into a fair bit. And that was brilliant for us. Obviously, we had our backs against the wall a fair bit. We obviously lost Tom Curry for the red card in that first game. We didn't have Owen. We didn't have Billy for the bans. And so, you know, it kind of freed us up a little bit, like, not having that pressure. And then, as you say, we actually exceeded expectations, you know, wrongly or rightly, and got to the semi-final. And then all of a sudden, you know, we were kind of free. And then that week was a massive, like, it was like, whoa, now there's actual real pressure. We obviously played Fiji, and that was a pressurized game because, you know, we lose to them, that would be seen as a disaster in the eyes of the public, although they're a very, very good team. And then you get to the semi-final, and then there was a lot going on. I remember I had a press conference with Joe Marchant on the day before the game, and one of the first questions from my head was, so the elephant in the room, Dwayne Vermeulen's, what, 30 kilograms bigger than you, how do you expect to deal with him? And I was literally, the first thing I said was, I haven't had that question before. Like, I've had that the whole of my career, but, you know, all of a sudden that's now an issue that hasn't been an issue for however many weeks I've been playing in that tournament for. But
what journalist was it? Was it an English or
it was an English journalist.
There you go. It's crazy.
And I just think it's really interesting when, like, there was no pressure and everyone was loving the team a bit, and then we got to South Africa and then everyone was like, can we make this uncomfortable? It felt like they were trying to make it quite uncomfortable for us. And then all of a sudden, you know, what, 65 minutes into the game, it felt like, you know, we were going to do a repeat of the 2007 run, you know, where no one gave us a chance. But yeah, I think there's a good lesson for us all there. Certainly media, certainly us as players, certainly the sport as a whole, certainly in with England, about, you know, create a bit of feel good. I know things weren't great in the warm-up games, but there was a lot of trust in that group that we were going to get it right by the time the tournament came around.
Yeah. Did it feel like the fans weren't behind you?
No, it wasn't the fans. I don't think... I never really felt like that the fans weren't backing England. I think they were all going a little bit reserved, but they were all going. That was the most important thing. And we were hearing them from home as well, which is brilliant. But I think it was more the media saying, you know, you're reading articles by ex-players, you're reading articles by respected journalists in the sport that were, you know, basically rubbishing individuals as personalities as much as team, as the team itself, which is, you know, I think it's always a bit tricky. Did it get ugly at times? I don't think it ever got too ugly, but I think it could have got, if results hadn't gone the way it did, it could have got pretty personal.
Yeah. And how did you deal with that as players?
Well, firstly, it's not like we weren't speaking about it. We were saying some stuff like what was being said. Steve, in fairness to him, keeps his ear very close to the ground and has some people around him that are giving him some feedback in terms of the reception we're getting as a team. And I think it's important to notice when you are getting some of that stuff, because you can use it. It's not like you can just shut it away, and because it could be, you know, turned into something quite ugly. But, you know, we used it in the right way on the whole. If anything, it made us more stoic in terms of like, we're going to stick to how we're doing this because we're trusting this is going to work. And lo and behold, you know, until, like I say, 15 minutes left in the semi-final, it sort of did work.
Yeah. You know, it's not an England rugby thing. It's not an Owen Farrell. This player, that player. It's a media thing with sport. I look at football, and I'm a big fan of football. Watched the Beckham documentary recently.
Brilliant.
And you forget about what happened with him in Argentina and the fact that he went on to captain England and how it all changes. Wayne Rooney is exactly the same. The stuff in the media around racism online with Marcus Rashford and some of the players. People are like, it's rugby. I know it's come to the fore now because of Barnsley. Obviously, recently, Owen Farrell was kind of the big, feels like a stake in the ground, but it's no change to what's happened over years and years of online abuse as long as it's been going. So it's a societal issue. It's not a rugby issue.
I definitely think so. I think it's 90% society, but also, as players are victims of their own success. You know, you're as successful as you are. Unfortunately, you do have to open yourself up to more spotlight, and that in turn means more criticism. Now, if it ever goes into or steps into a place where you can't go to, you know, racism, stuff that's way too personal, that is out of the order. But, you know, on the flip side, by being so successful, you do also open yourself up to criticism, and we really understand that. It's probably when it gets too far that other way, and you feel like this is now too much. And you've heard some perspective, like you touched on there, where people have, you know, been really, really affected by that. I thought that David Beckham, it was really interesting when he said that whole summer for him was almost wasted because he was just, you know, his head was in the sand. He didn't want to know.
Precious as a player now, what's it like being a professional player at the highest level?
I played my first game for Saris with you.
There you go.
You start against Bristol at home.
Oh, was
my
it?
My first Premiership game, and you were in the row with everybody else was playing. Para, Caruso, a few other boys, Billy. I came on for Kelly Brown. So it was Kelly Brown's, meant to be Kelly Brown's last game.
Okay.
And someone got injured, I think, in the week and the next game. And I thought Kelly, you know, maybe Kelly saying it's last game, maybe I might get another game. And someone came up to me and said, we have to play with Kelly because he's
good.
We have to play Kelly. So I was like, all right, fine.
But I coached you as well.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when we were 18, 19.
That was right. I earmarked yourself.
Yeah, it was Nick.
Yeah, Nick.
Jack
who
Ney.
Where's Jack Ney now?
I don't know. It's, again, like you say, the pressures of playing, like some people love it, some people don't. He played for a couple of years. I thought he was going to be brilliant. And then one day he said, I just don't enjoy it as much as you boys. And I think that's, again, another brave decision where kids nowadays, well, I say kids, young adults who come out of school, it's a big jump. It's a really big shift. And it's a bit of a sink or swim kind of thing. And you can, if you can withstand the first 3 or 4 years, which is tough, then you kind of feel like you can go on and be successful.
Well, with that, the stars need to align right as well.
Exactly.
Injury's a massive thing.
Yeah.
And me and Kelly, I mean, Kelly coached as well, and we had very different mindsets on like looking at a player.
Yeah.
He'd be like talking about players working off the ball and stuff like that. And be like, we went to watch a rugby game, a schools game in Colchester, and he's going mad at these kids saying, kick chase. I said, mate, fuck the kick chase. I said, you need to look at like the athlete.
Yeah,
I remember seeing some of you young lads. I think Max Malin. I wasn't sure whether Max would make it. Like athletically, I was just like, I don't know whether he'll be able to stand the test of physicality.
And in fairness, you were right. For a few years, he struggled. And then, you know, everyone grows up at different times. I think when he was 20, he started then tearing up trees in training. And everyone was like, well.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he's good.
But I athletically profiled yourself as a small back row.
Yeah.
To come through, and there
was
well, they
initially wanted to, when I was about 16, they wanted to turn me into a hooker.
Of course they did.
And I had no interest. So I said, well, if you want to turn me to hooker, I'll probably go somewhere else if that's all right. Or, you know, I was interested. I love rugby league and I wanted to go. At that point, I was still like maybe interested in giving that a go.
Really?
And that, you know, if they were like, no, we see you as a hooker, I'd have probably.
Why? Because it happens a lot. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have much interest in being in that middle of that scrum, if I'm honest. Mm. And also just think, there's a lot going on there. There's a lot to think about. And I've definitely found that when I play my best, I'm not, if you're thinking, it's almost too late for me. So I like being as free as I can, very little responsibility in terms of like set piece throwing, set piece scrummaging. There's a lot that goes on the shoulders of a hooker, which is why someone like Jamie probably took a few years to develop. And then the moment he's developed as much mentally as physically, he's just gone on and been unbelievably successful.
Mm. Lowest paid position.
Lowest paid
as well. Again, can you believe it?
I don't like that. I don't like that. The fact that they come out and say with those stats, I think that's unhealthy.
Crazy. It is very unhealthy.
I think it's not. But that again is like a rugby league NFL thing. Like they like saying what positions get paid the most and stuff, which I think is interesting. But within reason, I don't love it that it's been like exposed to the outside world.
See, I think so. All salary should be
kept
out
in
there.
House.
No, I think it should be out there. Do you not think it would just throw a cat amongst the pigeons? Yeah, definitely.
But then all of a sudden you get paid badly, and then you all of a sudden someone's messaging you saying, "How can you get paid X and do that?" And that's another.
Yeah, very
but
true.
But we go back to what we were just saying there. So
yeah.
But in terms of the pressures of playing,
well, just overall, yeah. Like, is it as good as you thought and as good as you hoped? Because you've had a very up and down kind of start, and
definitely.
I say that where you were playing some of your best rugby and you weren't in, and then.
Yeah,
there was all this talk about why you weren't in and then you're in, and all the pressure around playing for England, the stuff around Faz that we just mentioned. Just what's it like, just in general?
Well, firstly, when you first start, you're 18, 19, it's a dream. You get money in your pocket and you're playing rugby for a living, and it's amazing. Almost ironically, the hard work starts when you start playing regularly, and it's like you're grinding out games. So some of those boys that will have started at the beginning of the Premiership season, I think they're on their 10th game on the bounce, maybe 9th game. And, you know, their next break as such, forced break, will be the Six Nations. So that'll be beginning of February, end of Jan. So it's not as glamorous as it sounds with that. You can't really think that far ahead. It's normally week to week, and that can be exhausting. And that's probably why you see a lot of team performances go up and down. It's very rare that a team will consistently, certainly at this time of the year, just keep that diagonal trajectory, like, because to get up each week for a big game is impossible. And, you know, throw in the pressures of injuries, knocks, maybe not, you're not always playing at 100%. I mean, we would know, like, you rarely play 100%, maybe the first preseason game, and then you're nursing something. And then obviously the reviews, like, if you at Sarries especially, if we lose a game, it's, you know, at times it's been nothing short of a disaster, isn't it, when we've been there. And yeah, I guess there is a pressure that comes with that, but you've got to be pretty level, and that's something you probably learn as you go on. The best players I've played with are very level. You know, they look at the bigger picture. So I'll get Courtney Laws, you wouldn't know if he'd won by 50 or lost by 100. He's going to be the same guy. And that was the first big campaign I'd done with Courtney that World Cup, but I thought that was pretty interesting in terms of the different characters, but how successful Hugh can be by being a bit different.
Yeah, he was epic.
Well, he's epic. I don't think I've ever seen him have a bad game. So.
No, I would say he's one of the best players of our generation, of my generation. Like, I played against him loads, and he's still going. And then I think almost retiring from England, you're thinking, he's probably on the way out, like, as in just from the outside looking in.
He won't be as good for
the he won't be as good.
The weekend he was.
He might go and take a check immense. In France, and like against you boys, he got man of the match as well.
Yeah,
didn't
he was immense. In fairness, they were immense. I thought they were brilliant.
He was phenomenal. The fact that I've said about being a hype man and keeping things positive, something not negative, but maybe something that'd be really good to talk with you about and address. I don't know if you saw what Carl Sinclair said about the pressures of like going from international and then playing club rugby and the support not being there. I'll put it out there, and I've always said it, I think it's madness the amount of games that you have to play. I think it was mad the amount of games I had to play back to back, and how you got to the weekend was crazy. And that's a story for another day. I don't know how you come out of a World Cup, and I don't know whether you feel it's a blessing in disguise. You'll probably say that it's not. But to come out of a World Cup and all the pressures and everything that we've kind of spoken about, to then go into a Prem and then go into a Champions Cup and then go straight into a Six Nations, I don't know how any player sustains performance. I just think it's impossible to do. As a player, like Sinks is, you know, you don't need to say what he says. I don't know if you feel that, but is it just head down and push effectively? Because it's quite an ask, isn't it? But you're injured now.
Yeah.
A welcome break or not, or it, you know, if you can still see a silver lining of being injured.
Definitely, I think I'll divide my answer into two parts. I think firstly, you're definitely right. I think players will have to be managed slightly differently from now on in that regard. And I think this is obviously a bit different year because the World Cup obviously only every 4 years and whatever, but you have to be managed, and we had the enforced week. You had to have a week off in the first 4 weeks, I think, post the tournament. And that was really useful. But I think as well, I remember there was one moment I came back from Paris. It was a Sunday. On the Monday, we had the Monday off before training on the Tuesday, and sat home, and I just couldn't believe that was it. That was like the World Cup over. And then I had to start thinking about pairing. We played Leicester that weekend, and it was like a pretty, like took me back. I was not emotional, but I was just a bit like, can't believe that I've done all that, and that's all happened, and that has been amazing. But that's just it. Like, it's just clean cut. You've ripped the Band-Aid off, and now you're back to well, club life. And I love the club, and I think that's where you've got to find something else that keeps you engaged. That not it doesn't have to be rugby. It can be something at home. So if you've got family, obviously spending time with family. For me, I'm not at that stage in my life yet, but I've got other things that keep me really engaged, you know, that I enjoy doing, that I've been able to not do when I was at the World Cup. And hopefully, like you say, being injured for the next 3, 4, 5 weeks is going to give me an opportunity to, again, reflect so that I'll come back around Christmas so refreshed, so recharged and you know, ready to go.
Yeah, do you think it's a lot on players?
I do. I think I don't know why it's different to maybe some players that have done it previously, but it definitely feels like there's a bit more. I think, firstly, I think the game's a bit harder. I think, as we touched upon earlier, the concentration, the quality of the Premiership is now probably better than ever before. We've showed in our campaign so far, there's no such thing as a guaranteed win. We've had to pretty much scrap our way for every win and try and scrap away out of every loss. Then you obviously go and play in the Champions Cup and you're playing against, it may not be the biggest level playing field around, against teams in France, with our teams in South Africa right now, which is obviously brilliant, but it's not something you need all the time. But I think, the game's probably a little bit harder than it was in terms of being able to plot your way through the season, and also the squads are a bit smaller. So, you know, obviously when we were at Sarri's, the rotation stuff that was going on was brilliant because it was keeping players fresh for games where you know that you needed to win or you know were important. Now the game's so intense that you can't really afford to field a weaker side. So, you know, you're farming out your best players, or what is perceived to be your best players every week.
And how's training? Because when I was there and you were a youngster coming through, on a Tuesday, you're getting monstered by yourself. Yeah. Hayden Stringer. My goodness, man.
Tarzan.
Oh, my. Tarzan, yeah. I actually thought he was a good player. He's playing in France now.
Australia now.
Is he Australia?
Yeah, he was in France for a few years.
He was a Brive, wasn't he?
Yeah.
For a bit. But you young lads coming through, I remember Scout Berger, we were laughing our heads off, me and him were reminiscing when we were in Marseille and had a catch up, and like he was the most chilled out Scout Berger, which was crazy, wasn't it? Because he was an animal.
Yeah.
And I saw the one moment where Hayden Stringer sat him down on a bag, and Scout Berger went back to 2007 Scout Berger and monstered him. But the physicality of training then and the amount of contact we did, is there as much now, or is it?
It's a lot more regulated. Okay. It's a lot more regulated, and you know. I remember these moments, but you know, when we'd have line-out sessions and you just couldn't quite get the dominance as the playing team that's going, and one more. They don't do that anymore. It's you've got a set number and that's it. You know, if you don't get it, you've got to take the lessons from that and crack on. But there's certainly that. But you know, you touch on that, like the lads in training. I always used to think that obviously you're doing the best for the team, and I could understand why I used to get like the shit kicked out of me in training, because it was just a disaster. And now on the other side, you know, you're hurting after the game, you're 3 days after a match, and you've got a 21-year-old who's dying to be involved and is preparing the boys best he can. And you just don't need it, do you?
That's their cup final as well, isn't it?
Well, it was my cup final for 3 or 4 years. And it's like, and I can see now why people were getting so annoyed. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really understand at the time. And again, it's all about a maturing process, but that I can see that now. We're definitely managed better. Monday sessions are as light as they get nowadays. So you almost really train like 1.5 times a week. The rest is about knowledge, meetings, getting the vibe right for the week, for the weekend. But you're right. Those sessions were still pretty brutal.
Yeah. So is there still contact? I'm interested
not,
to know.
Not as much. Not as much now, just because, again, the way that we're being represented now by the RPA, they're limiting how much we're going to be able to do, which is great. And the whole point of training is so that you can perform on the weekend. And you can't perform on the weekend if you're nursing an injury from training, can you?
So, it's such a hard balance, isn't it? Because being conditioned, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, it is really interesting because I was a poor tackler, a chop tackler especially.
Yeah.
I could put my body in there, hit with my tits, I used to say, and that's why I had so many broken ribs. But I would have to constantly work on chop tackle.
Yeah.
So in order to get better at something, you've got to work on it. So with that stuff there, and it's interesting because the NFL are the same. They don't tackle. I had a guy called Adam Durda, who's the coach of the Dallas Cowboys. They don't even do contact. I was like, you can understand why, but it's almost like once you get into that system, you should know how to tackle. I don't know whether, as a specialist tackler and jackler, how much you actually do in training physically.
I don't do much in the actual session, then I'll do a lot of individual stuff. I think that's how you best work out as you get older, and I'm sure you had the same. You work out what you need and how you manage yourself. And like you say, some people train like there's no way they're gonna play at the weekend and then they're amazing. And there's some boys that really need to buckle up and impress in training to even think they've got a chance of playing well at the weekend. And I think that's where being as a team as connected as we are, we've been together for a long time, you work out how each player is and you work out what each player needs. So yeah, like I won't be chop tackling in training, but then afterwards get one of these young lads and get them running at me and vice versa. And you know, I remember the sessions I used to do with Skulk and you know, watching some of the boys do extras and stuff in training, Jackson Ray, for example, like those were the points I learned the most because it was one-on-one, unadulterated question time. And I just think it's important that we as players, certainly those experienced players, now give back in that regard as well.
Yeah, so will you chop tackle, like as in one-on-one, you'll go aside and do the micro skill?
Yeah. But again, it's on bags and you're landing on pads, so you kind of take a lot of the impact out of it. It's more about feeling and getting your body, like muscle memory, in the right place.
Yeah,
and jackling kind of the same. Jackling less so, because I think no picture's the same, whereas like, quite a lot of tackles are very similar, but jackling is no picture's kind of the same, so you're just kind of going off instinct as much as anything.
Yeah, because I suppose when you come back from your injury, you'll have to start chop tackling and get back into feeling the contact and stuff like that.
Exactly. It's nice to be able to feel my shoulders again though after a couple of weeks.
Tough old sport. It really is. What about in the gym and the conditioning? Because you look at the size now of you lads, like you're in good shape, you're thick as well, but the weights is obviously important, right? It's hugely important. But so how many weight sessions will you do in a test week, for example?
In a test week, you do two big sessions and one power session, which is kind of, you know, obviously you go from a club environment to an international environment and you may like to do some stuff on a Thursday that they don't put on a program. So it's kind of up to you. But yeah, the main two sessions are the Monday and the Tuesday, and they are, like you say, they're pretty heavy. But this year, for the first time during the World Cup, which I thought was interesting, is we had like prescribed weights. So you weren't allowed to like lift heavier than what was on your program, which I thought was interesting. So obviously there's an algorithm or a system that that built us up, and Aled Walters, you know, everyone sings his praises, he was brilliant in terms of you'd be like, Aled, I can lift heavy, like trust me, this is gonna be good for you. And you felt going into the game, you felt $1 million. Not that we haven't been looked after before, but it was a different way of doing it. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and what's the big focus for athletes now? Is it power, strength? Is it varying different positions? But for in the back row where you're in the ultimate position.
Yeah. So I think for the back row, it's a combination of three things. So I think it's strength. You've got to have a base. You've got to have a base level of strength. You've got to have the power to, obviously, you look at all the athletes nowadays in the back row, they're freaks of nature. And then a big thing that I think is coming in over time is mobility. Because I think you can, you know, we're all massive, but then it's about like how mobile are you? Can you get in these low positions? How quickly can you get off the floor? And it's about efficiency of movement. And I think the more mobile you are, the more flexible you are, the more you are able to manipulate your body in such a way, it relieves the stress on your body, I think.
Speed. That's one of your things.
I think the power of stuff kind of buys into that. But okay. I for one would maybe focus a bit more on speed than on the strength, because I will never be able to bench 190 kilograms because that's just not the kind of athlete I am.
What'd you bench?
I was 175. I did it yesterday. I did 175, but hopefully being hopefully not playing for a bit, I might be able to get it up. But
so if you're benching 175, like now when you're injured, so yeah. in, when you're playing,
when you're playing, because you'd be doing 150s,
okay.
160, and then but then when I'm not when I'm playing, usually I'll be doing a lot of speed work, because that's you've got to work out what your point of difference is, and that's probably my thing that maybe I have that maybe others need to work on.
Yeah, that is your point of difference. Speed and power. Mate, you've been class since you've managed to get the jersey. You were left out for a while. I actually saw something where you're quite vocal about being left out. You felt like you should have been. I love that. I think as a player, you can see where you are in the pecking order. You know what your output is in games. You know where you are. You were getting man of the match. It's not that getting man of the match is because it's from one commentator that gives you that. But let's go back a little bit through that. Like, how frustrating is a young man coming through? There was almost like this Alex Goode about a young Ben Earl. Like, is he going to get in, or is he just going to be this standout player in the Prem that everyone's talking about, which will then piss off the coach because everyone's talking about him. He's getting asked about Ben Earl, or why is Alex Goode not in? Why is he not in? It's always like, and there's that sense behind them that's like, you know what, fuck the media, I ain't picking Benno. How was it with Eddie? It just seems like he just didn't like you. Was that the case?
Well, I think, firstly, Eddie gave me my debut. Like, I had an amazing time in the first 3 years of my international career. Obviously, the big thing was that I never started a game, and that was, by the end, that was wearing on me quite a bit. And that was, I'd never really voiced my concerns, but kind of, I think he thought I was happy maybe sitting on the bench and, you know, picking up caps and whatever. And then he decided to go a different direction at the end of my time at Bristol. And
where you were brilliant Bristol was probably your best rugby.
It was where we were playing in a good team, and it was a weird time. And then, I came back to Sarries and was kind of not really worried about international rugby. I wanted to be back at the club and was enjoying it. And then, like you say, like, I felt like I was playing well, but wasn't getting picked and wasn't getting spoken to as well, which I think was as much as a frustration. If I was not getting picked and not being spoken to, if I was getting picked, not getting picked and being spoken to, why I wasn't, then I probably could make peace with that. I just wasn't being told anything. And I never outwardly said, can't believe I'm not getting picked. I was just saying how disappointed I was. When you play for England and have it taken away from you, it is gut-wrenching, and it kind of, you have to reevaluate what your why is playing the sport, because everyone wants to play for the nation. And yeah, it was really hard. And then to come back, you know, under Steve in a new regime was brilliant. And my appreciation for playing for England is sky high. I love it. I think it's the pinnacle of anyone's career. They're the best memories of my career.
Yeah, it looks like you enjoy it, especially with the whooping and hollering and stuff like that, which I enjoy. And again, I'm going to stick up for you on this one. I know what that is. I know what that means in terms of individuals doing that. Do you want to share why you do that? I've got a reason why I used to do it.
I think firstly, the people I grew up loving, taking inspiration from, all did it. And I thought it was a really crucial part of what Saracens were when we were at our most successful. So I probably took it out of that. But personally, for me, it's a really good way of me keeping myself engaged in games. You know, that rugby is, I think a hard game of rugby nowadays is about 37 minutes. So there's about 37 minutes of effort, and the rest is rest time. Ball's not in the play. So, you know, moments like that keep me engaged. If a scrum, we get a scrum penalty, I'm obviously not in the middle of a scrum, so I'm not like blowing out of my arse. I can really get the boys up for this. I can enjoy the victories. And I think on the same side, it's what it can do for the opposition. If an opposition sees me, we've had a long defensive set, we get a turnover and we're celebrating, it just shows that we've got so much more in us, and we do. And, you know, obviously boys are hands on head, hands on knees, on the floor, gasping for air. If I'm showing others that I'm ready to go, I'm showing the opposition I'm ready to go, that can only be a good thing for the team. And I've said to a few people that have asked me about it, I'll continue to do it. And if someone goes to me, Bennett, I really don't like it, it really off-puts me, and that's a player, a teammate, I'll stop in a heartbeat, then that's fine. But until that point, I'll continue to do it.
Yeah, and that's what I say when people ask about it. And it became more glaringly obvious as England were more under the scrutiny of the game plan and the way that they were playing. So celebrating the small wins. And that's what I would say. I would say as a player, it engages you in the moment. It almost like energises you. Yeah. And sometimes you're doing it for yourself. It's like a self-talk.
It's definitely.
And I used to play like that. I used to talk and speak, and not that anyone would be listening to it. I'd be doing it for myself.
Yeah.
And trying to find them small moments. And like, for the people that have never been in a scrum, Right, and you're pushing to the cow sheds and back.
Exactly.
And someone's trying to push your ass through your mouth and vice versa when I'm going through a prop. And you get the celebration of your players coming in. It's a collective. And then on the flip side of that, and you've just been hosed in the scrum and you hear everyone jeering. There's a psychological
influence. A big problem for mine when I was younger, and we talk about growing up as a player, was like I would be very inconsistent in games. I'd have like an amazing 5 minutes and then I wouldn't touch the ball for 10 minutes, or I wouldn't make a tackle, or my body language would be poor. I just found it was a really good way. I remember speaking to Al about it, Al Sanderson, when he was at Saris, trying to find ways of keeping me engaged in moments so that I was staying, you know, and switched on. And like you say, it's not for long. It's 37 minutes. You do 2-hour exams at school nowadays, which is just bonkers. So like, you know, that was a way of really engaging me. I remember training with a mic on a couple of times and reviewing what I was saying to others and how I was talking to myself, and again, that's kind of the result I came up with.
So you're micing yourself up as well?
I did. When Al was there, we used to mic myself up for training and like listen to what I was saying, and obviously like that does make you more outgoing. It does make you want to say it. But then
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Like, I found that I'd get to end of sessions and be like, wow, I felt like I've fully engaged in every moment. Did I make the right decision every time? No, but was I engaged? Yes. Mm. Which it's probably a bit of a work on for a lot of young players, is because you come from a system where you're a school or club and you're the best player, and you can kind of get the ball when you want, make the tackles when you want, and it goes well. And then you come to you're then a small fish in a very big pond, which is professional rugby. You come into Saris and you've got to try and find your niche again. It's a tough lesson to learn.
How old are you now, Ben?
25.
A lot's happened.
It's a long time.
I say a lot's happened. You think about your career and the ups and downs of being in and out of the England setup.
Yeah.
The stuff at Saracens, going to Bristol. Yeah. How important do you think that Bristol time was to have a break from Saracens with everything that was going, in terms of growing up, being in a different environment, seeing the way they do things?
I mean, it's an interesting story, because I remember I'd just had my first selection for England, and we were in Portugal in Browns, and we always used to go there, and Eddie took us all the Saris players into his room or his meeting room, and we were all sitting around a circle, and he was like pointing to all the boys, you can stay, and then he came to me, and I was actually the last one. He said, you're probably gonna have to go and play in the Premiership. So all of a sudden I'm like, gosh, obviously I want to stick around, I love the club.
So it came from him?
Well, he was the one that was saying you'd have to go, but you know, if you want to stay, then you know, then you're kind of, it's a roll of the dice whether you'll play for England whilst you're there. We came back from the Six Nations and...
Sorry, but it was just simple as that. So you're in a room in Portugal.
Yeah.
And he's just got you, and he's been like, right, you can stay, Billy, Owen.
Yeah, Owen,
Marrow,
Jamie,
Elliot.
And then I
were
was
you
like,
the only one?
I'm trying Max to remember well. Now. Max wasn't in the camp at the time. No, yeah, I might have been the only one. I can't. Jack Singleton was there as well. So okay. Jack Singleton was told he'd have to go as well. Anyway, we had these meetings, and Brendan Vence was there, and Mark and Phil, and I'd come in with a bit of like a pretty thing. And I was like, I'm gonna try and say this in the right way, but I think it'd be the best for me with my international aspirations and for my development as a player. That I try and not make it all about playing for England. Anyway, in fairness to them, they front-footed it and was like, Ben, we feel you need to go and keep playing the Premiership. You've been brilliant for us, but you know, we want you to go as a young player and come back as a seasoned professional. And so it was then like, well, what club's going to work? And a lot of clubs, obviously, having the opportunity to have young players coming through that they were quite keen at the salary cap stuff. They were, it was all going to go on to Saracen stuff, so it wasn't actually a burden for the club. And there was a few clubs floated around, and we ended up at Bristol, and then Max ended up, and we both went down in the middle of lockdown. That was a, that was our first time, and we loved it. It was very different. The city's brilliant. I love Bristol, love the city. And the players, obviously, some of the players we got to play with were amazing. In terms of what it did for me, firstly, it gave me such clarity that I loved Sarries. That was the club I wanted to be at. Now, obviously, Bristol was amazing. We had amazing memories. We had an amazing team. I made some mates for life there. But it reaffirmed to me how much I loved being, that was like my club. And actually, funny enough, my first game for Bristol was against Sarries, and my first game back at Sarries was against Bristol. Mm. So I've had it both ways. And the second thing it did for me is that, like, it taught me how to keep backing up games. Like, when I was playing at Sarries just before I left to Bristol, I was starting to get into the team, but, like, not regularly again. I left never having played for England. I came back having played 13 times for England and played 40 times for Bristol. And, you know, those 40 games for me were invaluable. And I came back, you know, like Smalley wanted a bit more of a seasoned professional, a bit more of a leader. And yeah, it was, like I said, it was a great thing for my career. And it was great for me that I came back knowing that Sarries was my place. Whereas other people might have come back and said, oh, I did enjoy Bristol. Like, it would be quite good to go back there or another club. So yeah, that was probably...
Well, that's what Max has done.
It is what he's done.
But I don't know, you don't know how the timing of contracts and stuff like that, his value would have gone up. And,
definitely.
Yeah, what were these like, as in Semi and Charles Piatt? I think he was a little bit injured, Charles, when you were there.
Those boys had a great time. They would not train all week and then play amazingly at the weekend. And it was like, well, there you go. That's why they're the best players in the world. Him, Stephen Luatour, even some people that you wouldn't think of. So, like, having the opportunity to play with, like, Dan Thomas was amazing. Harry Thacker, what an amazing player.
He's wicked, he is.
And then, obviously, you know, like the likes of Semi, Luke Morahan, Charles Piatel, those guys would just do amazing things on the rugby pitch. And we had a really good team. And that was probably a big regret of mine still. And, you know, obviously the boys that are still there is that Istanbul game against Quins and what could have been. Because, you know, we probably should have won that league that year and we didn't. And I don't know if it's had an effect on the club, but it certainly had an effect on me for a few weeks after that. Mm. It took a long time to get over that.
So Bristol finished top that season, didn't they? And then it was that Harlequins game that went into extra time, or not?
Well,
you're winning.
No, it did go into extra time though. We were up by, I think we were up by like 25 points.
Yeah, that
could
was
even
the one.
Be less,
yeah.
Could even be more. And Alex Dombrecht scored just before the stroke of half time, and it was like 25-7. And I remember going to the change room, and everything you shouldn't hear at 25-7 in a semi final, you heard like. I remember, you know, maybe a few sly comments about Twickenham and get with Twickenham and let's just get this half done, boys. Let's just see it out.
Okay.
Whereas actually, you know, we were at our best when we were attacking games, when we had the ball, and, you know, the writing was almost on the wall in hindsight. And yeah, a big regret of mine. But again, another lesson learned. Like, I learned, you know, big games require a commitment for the full 80 minutes. And then coming back to Sarries and playing in semi-finals and finals and being a bit more successful again, it's just another lesson that I've learned.
Well, it shows you, doesn't it? And history will tell you that you have to be in these semis and finals. You have to lose a final to win a final.
Exactly.
Like, you look at Sale against you boys last year in the Prem. Like, Sale will be there or thereabouts. Yeah. But the thing is for Bristol is they're not there or thereabouts, are they? So them experiences with the same players are no longer there because you're not there and Semi's not there and Charles Piatel, they've had a big, kind of, not a big turnover, but they've had a few turnover.
Yeah, exactly.
So Saracens, why the love of Saracens so much? And people will hate on me because I love Saracens so much. People have long memories or short memories, however you think, back to everything that happened there. Mm. I can't speak about the place any higher I already do. But as a player that's in it, can you maybe try and contextualise what it is about Saracens that you love so much?
I think there's two things. There's the people, and everyone talks about Saracens talking about the people and stuff, but the people are magical. They care about the club. They've been at the club for, you know, as long as anyone that Mark McCall must be at the club for 15 years now. And it's very rare to find that in modern sport. And the second thing is, like, the way that we're looked after as players, the way that the soft touches around the club, the way that we're actually looked after, the way that we're respected, the fact that, like, you can have three different players leading three different meetings in a week, leading huddles, reviewing games by themselves, it's just a magical place to be. And like, if you can't help but get involved, you can't help but learn, you can't help but get better as a player and as a person. And I just think it's home. For me, it was home. That was the thing. My parents loved it. I love it. It was everything that I wanted out of my rugby career, and it's everything that I continue to want with at the club.
Yeah, you look at how they treat people after, and I know there's no loyalty in sport, as they say, but I just look at what they do for the players after. I'm looking at Duncan Taylor, one of my good mates who I played for Scotland with. He's now the women's coach and head of admin as well.
Head of alumni, I think,
is that what it is? He's sending all these messages. You look at Juan Figuelo, same thing.
Scrum coach,
and he comes through and he's coached the women. Mo Botha's back at the club doing what he's doing. Yeah. I just think... And that's just a name three. Like, I could give you a list of names.
I'm sure you're going to see, my premonition in 10 years' time is that you're going to see a handful of players that are playing for us now as our coaches. And I think that'll be great. And that'll be amazing if that's the case. I think it's a place that once you're there, you can't help but get swept up in it, like I say. And obviously you've experienced that. And the likes of Scott Britz and Scott Berger, like those guys have come and have stayed friends for life. And Marcello Bosch, you don't get the opportunity to meet these people very often. And Saracens facilitated that. And for that, we'll be eternally grateful.
Yeah. You can see Faz going on to coach, can't you? He already coaches, doesn't he?
He is our coach. So
he is
your
coach.
He's one of our coaches.
I've heard that there's like a not a shift, because when I was there, he was coaching as well, but it was more kind of in and out. But from everything you hear now, that Owen Farrell was effectively like leading the charge, and Smalley and Mark McCall and Kev Sorrell have given him the keys to the kingdom. Has he evolved in that space massively now?
I think a handful of people have. I think you see Mauro, Jamie, Owen, Mako, Billy, they all kind of take the mantle on in different areas. Like, I always think Billy's incredibly good at gauging where we are emotionally as a group, and he talks a lot about that, whereas Jamie's very technical, very, this is what needs to happen line out wise, this is what needs to happen scrum wise, in relationship with Mauro as well. And then Owen kind of underpins a lot of the stuff. It's certainly an attack. He's brilliant. And I mean, honestly, every time there's a team meeting, like, you think as a young player, oh, you have to learn so much. I'm still young, but I'm learning so much in every meeting. Like, he's seeing something that I would never look for. And I think that's amazing. And I think that's testament to not only his hard work, but the hard work the club do and the license they give us as players to get a hold of it. And you know, I get rung by Adam Powell most weeks. Even now I'm not playing at the moment, you know, what have you seen from X and Y, you know, what have you seen from the Bulls and stuff, and you know, you're thinking about the game in a better way. You're educating yourself the whole time.
Exactly, they just give you that forum to kind of pass opinion. They realize that you lads probably know the feel and understand the game just as much as
they
do. And I suppose it's having that humility to be able to say, ring up a 25-year-old lad and be like, mate, you're not just a 25-year-old lad, you're an international, you're seeing stuff that we won't catch.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's great they do that, as well as the experienced players. For me, like, Jamie George is one of the best players I've ever played with, just a natural leader.
Yeah,
as well.
And I can't remember last time I saw him make a mistake in anything. I mean, obviously the one
dodgy line out.
I mean, and again, do you see him in that when it happens? Like, he's the first one to laugh at himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I think if you were to talk about like a true Saracen, I don't really love that saying, but like, he'd be a lot of stuff from him would be what you'd build.
Yeah, 100%.
If you're building someone that was like, what was a Saracen's player, you take a lot of his assets.
Yeah. Hopefully people are still listening to us because we're going all in on Saracens. But so Faz has stepped down. So next England captain, there's a few names out there. Mauro, Jamie as well, two Saracens. Would you put your hand up if it came to you?
If Steve asked me to do it, I'd love to do it. But
would you love to do it with everything that comes with it? You listen to Rob Shaw, you listen to Faz.
I think, again, ignorance is bliss. It's England captain, like, it's everything you'd want it to be. Now, what comes with the role, there's a lot that comes with it, and that would have to obviously be expressed beforehand. But
what comes with it, just on that?
I think, do you think as a player that comes with being the captain, you're the face of the team. If you're very successful, it's obviously probably a great place to be, and if you're not as successful as you should be, probably not a great place to be. And obviously there's a lot of corporate stuff, a lot of behind the scenes stuff that you've got to show up to, a lot of community work, which is obviously brilliant. We love doing that, but you know, I'm sure there's a lot to it, and then just on top of that, you've got to play really well for your nation, because you're playing for your country, you've got to lead by example as much as anything. And the best captains I've played under always did that. They always, you know, some were talkers, some weren't, but they always played well. And yeah, I think it's a really interesting time in terms of that captaincy discussion. I think, like you've mentioned, Marrow, Jamie, Ellis Genge, George Ford, all amazing players, amazing leaders in their own right. So it's a really interesting conversation, and I'm just looking forward to seeing who gets the nod and looking forward to seeing where they can take the team.
Yeah, because it is more, isn't it? People will maybe casually think, oh, it's just you leave your team at the weekend.
And you decide if you kick the goal or kick for the corner. Like,
of course, but there is so much more in the world now. Like, we're talking about growing the game, whatever that means. But the front in the media, you know, like, as in, it's a thing, isn't it? There's almost like a responsibility now to engage. And maybe this is one thing, Ben, that we can talk about, because Steve's not great at that. He'll be the first to say that that isn't the world that he enjoys being in. You know, I've heard that he was working on stuff like that. He had all his interviews from when he was at Leicester and working on how to engage. Do you think there is a responsibility to do that? Do you think you have to be able to engage with the media, not be charismatic, but almost just give them a little bit to fall in love with you and the team to help make them follow you?
Well, I think my experience of when media's done well and not done well, I think firstly, honesty rules. So I think it's amazing when the England captain has to, 5 minutes after a drubbing or a win, has to run into the media room and field questions. And, you know, I think honesty is always the first place, and, you know, and not be generic, actually pinpoint what's going on if there is a problem. Because at the end of the day, everyone wants the team to do well, but you just, sometimes it's a bit painful, and we've all seen and we've all said it, like, oh, you know, we're just trying to get better. We're just trying to, you know, we're all about performance. Like, oh, you know, we didn't do this. It's obvious, like, why, you know, why didn't we do that? And that's, I think, probably where I say we've got a responsibility as players to give a little bit more in terms of the insight of what we as a team are thinking about, without obviously giving away the game plan and whatever. But yeah, I think you're right. I think honesty, we weren't good enough today is like automatically endears yourself to the media. The moment you say, yeah, you know, we lost, and all of a sudden they're like, yeah, but come on, give us a bit more.
Mm. It is really hard, isn't it? Because I'd watch all the press conferences, because even if there was a small anecdote that you could take out, and it's my job, right, to look at all that stuff. But I just know when I listen to Steve and Faz, I know that you'd get, like, nothing. It would be about getting better, and it'd be about week on week. It'd be about that game. And I'm like, but what else can we... I'm trying to think to myself, like, what else are we looking for? Like, as in, like, do we even need that? I mean, what are you going to get? And I looked at all the press conferences. So I'd watch New Zealand, you know, Ian Foster and Sam Kane, exactly the same.
Yeah, but like you said, it's so hard after the game. Of course. Like, it's brutal.
Of course. But like, even before the game, in the lead up, like, you're not going to say anything that's going to upset it. I was chatting to my mate about it. It's like, why don't they just go out there and just say, right, we've got Portugal at the weekend. Like, we expect to be 50 points better than them. If we don't put 50 points on Portugal, there's an issue. And I said, yeah, but rugby's not like, it's not like that.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side of it, but then really you look at other sports, it's like boxing and UFC, I'm going to knock him out. This guy's a fucking mug, and I'm going to actually, this guy's a really good fighter, and you know, there's a chance I might lose this if I'm not in the game. It's just all out, as in complete. I know it's a completely different sport, but I don't know. I think we've gone down this rabbit hole now, haven't we? And Eddie Jones dug himself down that rabbit hole where he's offering people to uppercut themselves and doing all. He just throw ridiculous anecdotes. I just don't know what we're getting out there, but I think the honesty one is like leveling with people and trying to find that emotional level. But 5 minutes after a game is so difficult, so isn't it?
Because and I don't envy anyone who's had to do it. I mean, I think it's interesting now they're doing those at the end of half-time chats. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think you've got to pick the right person as well.
Because, you've got to pick the right people.
If you actually want to get something, but then make sure you can use it. I think there's a handful of people in every team that you'd want to pick.
Yeah, it's a really hard position at the minute, because we are in this weird place, aren't we? Especially with the England team, where there is that narrative around it with everything that's happened that we're talking about, then moving forward. But you're still one of the best teams in the world. Like, you made the semi-final, nearly beat, should have beat South Africa, and been in another final. And we're talking about the public trying to fall back in love. I think it was just a bit of an anomaly, that Fiji.
We were training very hard. And I know, like, we said it at the time, but the training we were doing, was there were big sessions. So we were playing... it almost felt body-wise we're playing like two, maybe three times a week. And that's not to say that we shouldn't have played better and stuff. We definitely should have, and we didn't play well. And, you know, every game was slightly different. I mean, if you look at those warm-up games, we had the two games against Wales, one loss, one, you know, last-minute win against, with 12 men. And then we played Ireland. And, you know, at the Aviva, it doesn't get much tougher than that. And then playing Fiji that were looking a really good side. And you know, we didn't play our best stuff. All of a sudden, it changed the narrative of our team. So yeah, I think the way that we were managed physically was brilliant. It did maybe hold us back in the warm-up games, but meant that we were so ready for that first game.
Who was the hardest game? Where you were like, holy shit. I mean, even in the lead-up, that Fiji game looked absolutely insane, where I was like, they were so on.
Yeah.
They were unplayable.
They were very good. I think the team, the one game I said was like, wow, was probably the Ireland game in Ireland. They were very good. And I thought we actually weren't that far off it, and we had some opportunities to make it at least closer, and they just blew us away with they're just so clinical. They were so clinical with ball in hand and how they exited, how they got the ball back. That was a really good lesson for us as a team in terms of like how simple we can make the game, how effective it can be when we all do our individual roles really, really well.
And my mate was saying when we were talking, I think Leinster played Gloucester and we were almost laughing about it, and I was like, how physical? And he said it wasn't the physicality. He said, yes, they're physical. The likes of Doris, Josh van der Fleer, Sheehan, Porter, Furlong, Tyburn, they've got world-class players. He said it was the speed. He just said the speed, it was just like you couldn't even process how quick Ireland were. Is that the level of like when you're out there as a player? Is it like, again, Fiji had that kind of speed when they play, but what is it that really makes a difference from like a world-class team to the best team?
Good question. I think every team nowadays is good defensively, and most teams have good maul, most teams have good scrum, although, you know, some are obviously better than others. I think attack is obviously the bit that separates, and I think attack takes the longest to get right. And obviously Irish players are on the whole very lucky. They get to play with each other for almost the whole year before they play for Ireland. Yeah, speed, but clarity. I think it's the more simple you can keep. Rugby players are pretty simple beings. So the more simple you can keep individual roles, and I mean, that's where Steve's brilliant. Steve will tell you exactly what he wants from you in almost every facet of the game. And, you know, for a Carl Sinclair, he'll be saying, I just want you to get us go forward ball. You know, I want to maybe get set piece dominance. And then all of a sudden, my mind's focused on just those two things rather than thinking about the thousand things that are going to go on in the game. And I think that's where Steve got the best out of a lot of us, was keeping it really simple. And I think that's where England are probably going to develop. We're going to bring more speed into our attack. Obviously, Wiggy was brilliant in the World Cup, and you know, we've got a lot of work to do, but we saw some early signs of us getting a lot better in that.
Yeah, you've got to think how tough it was. This is me speaking for you as a team. A new coaching team going into a World Cup. You think of all the other teams. I don't know if there was any team that had the changes
I can't think of one in
the leader. We think of all the big teams. So France Gaultier was on a four-year cycle.
Yeah.
South Africa is what South Africa is. Foster's been there for a long time. Yeah. I know Australia, but they weren't in the mix. Gatlin was back from a Welsh perspective. Fiji had a settled team and a group of players. Like, you had a completely new backroom staff. Wiggy just came into the mix. And I suppose, and again, I was having this conversation with a few mates when we were watching it, around the kicking. And I was like, look, I was at Saracens where we started that kick and then they added layers of attack.
Yeah.
You look at Leicester, how they won the Premiership. There's a science behind it. They're not just kicking the ball for that. I mean, maybe just as a player in that conversation, where you're at Saracens now playing this unbelievable brand of rugby, but being in the England team where there was this... there was a bit of frustration with the crowd when there was a lot of kicking. Just the reason why teams kick so much.
Yeah, there's a data algorithm that shows that the team with the longest kick meter, who kicked the most meters in a game, tends to win. Has like an 80-90% chance. I don't know. Obviously, as a rugby player, it's easy to explain why that would be the case. But basically, you keep putting pressure on the opposition until they kick it off, you get a set piece, or you win the ball back in the air. I think before going into the World Cup, the team with the longest kick meter was France. And to think that was the case, you know, and you initially think French rugby, Flair, amazing players, Dupont, Entermac, these massive ball carriers, but actually they would kick the longest and the most in any game. So it's an algorithm that is the case, and it's about pressure. And a lot of we were physically conditioned to play that game, like kick long back, long duels, staying in it, and then pulling the trigger at the right moment. Whereas other teams might get bored. Certainly, we felt against the Fijian team, they wouldn't be able to outlast us in a kicking duel. They would, and when we say breaking a kicking duel, would probably be running it back or kicking a bad kick back. And that would be the time where we'd be able to dominate them with our defence or our counter attack.
But they kicked well, actually, against... They'd improved massively.
Exactly.
That was the difference.
Now no longer... You know, there was always probably a feeling around Fijian teams and most of the island teams would be like, you'd be really up against it for about half an hour and then you'd grind them down. That's no longer the case. I mean, we played Samoa in the group stage. I mean, you look at that team sheet now, that is amazing, amazing team sheet. So, yeah, I think it's great that rugby's realising the importance of the island teams and we'll be better for it.
And hopefully there's more of an understanding of the strategy. I think people want blood. They want offloading. They want the speed, which I understand there's an excitement around that. But I'm a purist. I love scrum. I love line out. I love the kicking contest.
There's like a tactical element to the game, which I think is great. And yeah, you see, for example, we actually talk a lot about, we had Vincent Kompany in the preseason with England. He was talking a lot about how Pep would have his stuff and talking about pressure. And sometimes pressure is just keeping the ball where you can. So for Pep, it was about like moving the ball, but not always being like that incisive, trying to get into the box. It'd be just like trying to get them to come to you, which I think is really interesting. Sometimes by just kicking the ball back, you actually just keep putting pressure on the opposition, which is, you know, it's not always the most interesting, but then it opens itself up to opportunities later on in the game.
Yeah, and that's why I knew in that semi-final against South Africa, I looked at the conditions and people were like, oh, England are going to get monstered it. And I said, I'm telling you now, I said, the way that England play, and I saw snippets in that game against Ireland in the Six Nations where Freddie went off for that ridiculous red card, that I knew that you would trouble South Africa. Like, what was it like being in that game? Because when no one gave you a chance, I know you didn't win it, so we're not sat here saying, the last 15 minutes was a mental, mental finish. But what was it like being in that game against...
It's probably still my most favourite game I've ever played. And that's ironic because obviously we lost. But I think what was great was that everything we prepared for in that week, we did in terms of mentally and physically. That was the most physical performance I can remember. I was certainly playing for England. The England teams I've played in, that was the most physical team I've played in. And then also playing the people that I'd like looked up to and playing Dwayne Vermeulen, I used to watch his highlights. And I think that's really cool. And I've not had many opportunities where I've been able to do that. So to share a beer with him after the game and to swap shirts, that was a pretty cool moment. And yeah, like you say, I think on the whole, we were really pleased with opportunities. We remember reviewing that game. Well, I say reviewing, we kind of brushed over it pretty quickly because we obviously had the bronze playoff, but we had one line out, and I think it was in the second half, I think, and we either threw a not straight or got turned over on their 5 metre. And if we'd have just come away with something at that moment, it could have been a lot different. But yeah, you know, that team was a young team. We've learned a lot from that. The likes of George Martin. I mean, how good was he that game?
But I knew who talking of watching young lads, I did a doc with the Leicester Academy.
Right.
With Jack Van Poorfleet was in the team, Freddie Stewart. And they were like, oh, which one? I said, this George Martin. He had a beard at the age of 16, 17. Yeah. I said, his athleticism, his tackling ability, which has obviously now come to the fore, his body positions when hitting another human. Yeah. I was like, this lad's going all the way.
Yeah, exactly.
He was, I don't know why they brought him off. I mean, again, there'll be a reason for that. He was absolutely
immense. He was brilliant.
Against the biggest opposition on the planet.
Yeah.
Did it feel like that or not when you were playing? Because you were so dominant physically in the collisions, in the breakdowns.
Definitely. I think it was like, okay, this is going well. But I reflecting, looking on our team, like we weren't small. And that was like the likes of Joe Marler, Dan Cole, Jamie George, that's like the biggest know-how front row I think you can have around nowadays. And they were brilliant. And then having the likes of Courtney, Tom Curry, you know, he's played 50 games for his country at 25. Those games are only going to stand that team in good stead.
That's what I mean. You look at the players you've got, you actually start name-dropping the players. And I think this is the expectation from England fans, maybe, that they want it now. Because you think of the World Cup, 2019, finalists, 07, finalists, 03, won it. Like, consistently, one of the best teams out there. And the quality, like, you lads are going to be all right. You know, once you get it right.
And Steve's brilliant. Steve's going to be brilliant for us, and he's very level in terms of his messaging and making sure that we're keeping our feet on the ground and also where the team can get better. It's going to be an exciting time, hopefully.
Yeah, my mate Deeks was at Leicester with Steve said he is all in on the players, as in you are number one. No, which is a weird thing to say, but not all coaches. It is like Eddie Jones. He's the number one, and his mates around him, it seems like that's what it is. But everything that he said about Steve, like, as in, they'd be in a meeting at 7:30 in the morning, and a player would just kind of look at, and Steve would be up out the making sure that the players have absolutely everything they need. Because as much as he doesn't give to the media, apparently he gives everything.
Oh, yeah. He's brilliant. And his passion and his messaging and, yeah, the way he is around everyone is amazing. The environment was I couldn't tell how enjoyable it was being in that World Cup. It was really like a cliche say, but like a band of brothers. Like we spent a lot of time together. There was not cliques. It was just everyone was just mucking in, and it was brilliant. Like I said, made friends for life. Even Danny Kerr, he's a good mate of mine now. And never thought I'd say that.
That's because he's a Harlequin. That's exactly, why.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's testament to the work that Steve did.
Yeah. So what number did you have on in that semi? Were you wearing eight?
I was eight. I was eight. I think I was eight every game. I think. I'm trying to think. Oh no, we played Japan. I think I was seven.
What's your favourite number on your back?
I honestly don't mind.
Come on, give me one.
Make too much of a difference. I grew into number eight. I did really enjoy it. I did, and I played eight a lot when I was younger, and then obviously didn't grow from when I was like 11, so then ended up becoming a bit more of a seven, but I did really enjoy number eight.
So if you had to be buried in the shirt, you'd want the eight on the back or the seven, or does it depend how the years unfold?
Give me a couple more years to work that out.
Yeah, because I played four and five. Five was the moneymaker because she called the line out. But
is that right? I didn't know that. I've learned that today. Okay.
Yeah, so five's like the line. Well, no, it's changed now, but back in the day,
five called, four was
four tight was head the tight, but I was both. So I would scrummage on the tight head side and then call
and
the
then
line
Cruzo
out.
And Cruzo came along.
And Cruzo came along and just did everything. Oh, he's lost a load of weight now, hasn't he?
He's great. He's looking.
He came in, George Cruz came in, didn't he?
Yeah, so he was doing like a line out consultant role, and he was. It was brilliant. And Wiggy would tell a great story if you ever speak to him about it. So we had a sauna, and that was a great sauna culture in camp. And it was kind of like that was called the 8:45 club. So it was 8:45 at night, nice, dark. You'd be in the sauna, it'd be like firelit. So it's real peaceful and nice. Anyway, the coaches are like, they love it. They're dying to get in there, but they've just got a load of work to do and preparation and stuff for training the next day. Anyway, Cruzo swans in on the first day and is in there with the boys. He walks into the coach's office and sees Wiggy, and obviously knows Wiggy very well. He says, "Have you been in that sauna yet?" And Wiggy's like, "No, we've been here for 3 months, still haven't been in it, mate. You've been here for 5 minutes, you've been in." And I think, Cruzo's like a good link for like the coaches and the boys, and obviously his line-out knowledge is second to no one. Is brilliant.
Exactly.
And some of the plans he came up with, certainly against Africa, actually, some of the best stuff we did, certainly in defensively. I think that's testament to his coaching.
Yeah, it's great that Steve would bring someone like that in as well, which is his area. But I go back to it, I'd be buried in the number four jersey.
Number four.
Yeah, like Martin Johnson.
Yeah.
Like that.
Some good pedigree.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? I know it'd be a Scotland shirt, so it's not Martin Johnson.
I was going to say, you
wouldn't be. I remember who was wearing number four before me. Scott Murray wore five. Doddy Weir wore five as well. Number four for me. But you're buried in eight or seven.
Leave it with me. Seven. Can I have a slash?
I know it's a seven. I know. There's not much difference now, is there?
Not anymore. Especially not with like how interchangeable players are. Like the Courtney is like a six, could play in the second row, could play in the backs for all even. Like Tom Curry could play 7, 8, 6. Every player is slightly different. Like, we got Billy in the second row for Sarries the other week.
I bet you do.
And the props love that as well, actually. They think he was brilliant. So I think everyone's just a little bit more interchangeable. It's about hopefully getting your best players on the pitch and you know, performing in that regard.
Who does Ben Earl see as the best player at the minute? Ali Surveyor, World Player of the Year. Mm. Peter Steph Tatoy was unbelievable. Like, you'd be up near a World 15 as well. So
I'm going to say the best player I've played against is Bottier.
Lavani Bottier. He's incredible.
And And I just, there's nothing he can't do. And I think he's an amazing player. Like, obviously, I've not played against New Zealand before, but everyone says Surveyor, the Barrett twins are excellent. But the best player I've played against, I think now, would be Bottier. When I played him at La Rochelle, he was brilliant, and then reaffirmed his excellence when we played him in the quarters. He's made of nails. If he's anywhere near a breakdown, it's over. It's a turnover. And he's so good, you have to make plans for him. And I think that's testament of a really good player, is you make a plan to counteract what they're really good at. And we spent a lot of time that week, I remember, talking about Bottier and saying his name in training and stuff. He'd certainly be up there for me.
Hayden Smith tells a funny story about me when Scotland played the US.
Right.
So he had to wear my, like my jersey, my name on his back or whatever. I was the bib. So I'm thinking, fucking hell, mate, is that like, as in they saw me as like Scotland's best player? I don't know if you heard, it was the liability. So it was right. Like, as in, run at him, he can't defend. Yeah, he's going to give a penalty away at the breakdown. But no, Lavane Bottier, unbelievable. When you said people talk about Ardy Surveyor and the Barrett brothers, who is everybody?
The Farrells of the world would say Surveyor would be up there. Someone I think actually doesn't get a lot of applause, Deolande, the 12. I thought he was brilliant. That whole tournament was brilliant against us, really. I thought he was mega. He had a real intensity to him. I was like, it took me back. I was like, whoa, that's intense. I think that's, again, rugby's more as much physical, technical as mental. And there's, you know, you can have different facets to your game. So I think he's certainly up there as well.
Yeah, because when people ask you, it's the old saying when you go to one of these dinners and they're like, oh, who's the best player you played against or you played with? It feels like there's a shift now, because Lavane Bottier, as much as, yes, he probably could run over a lot of people, but that's not his super skill, is it, of running over people? It's the breakdown, it's the kind of dark arts, it's that kind of niggly style player that is constantly on the go. And Ronan O'Gara said the same. He said he's the best player he's ever coached. Yeah. In the Lavane Bottier, which is massive, isn't it? Think of Fijian, I don't know how old he is, he could be 50, but he's...
It doesn't matter. He looks great. He's moving well, so...
Yeah.
I like that little thing in that game where him and Curry, like, you could see that Bottier was about to swing, and I thought, I actually wouldn't mind watching that, because they're both pretty freakish physically, and I think I remember standing back and being like, oh, this could be fun.
Yeah.
See what happens there.
Before we go, just... like the England fans that are listening, and there'll be a decent demographic, there'll be some Scotland fans as well, so they'll fall in love with Ben Earl. But you need them, right? You need your fans. You need them to follow you, you need them to understand the process that you're going through. But I think as a team there's an expectation, isn't there, that they think England should be winning a Grand Slam next year, or that you should be winning a World Cup. But it's a difficult being in England. I can say this on the other side now, being a Scot, people don't like England, they don't like you, whatever reason that is. I think it's a historic thing. Just don't like English people, maybe that's what it is. I do. I'm a quarter English, sit here with a North Hebridean accent. Oh, I love England. Like, I do. Yeah. Like, I love you lads. I love Saracens. I love Leicester that I play for. Yeah. I love Gloucester. But it almost feels like there's maybe a reshuffle of fans falling in love with this England team.
Well, I think touching on that, I think everyone brings their best game against England, and I think that's testament to some of the successes the team has had over the years. In terms of the fans, the best, I'm not that emotional around playing and stuff, but I remember whenever I'm at Twickenham and hear the anthem, you can't help but bring a little tear to your eye, and I think that's testament to the fans that are there. In terms of where England's going over the next couple of years, I think you've got some really exciting players to get behind. Marcus Smith, obviously, on Friday was mega. Freddie Stewart looks like he's playing some of the best rugby of his life. And then you've got some young players that are coming through. Chandler Cunningham South looks like a really, really good player. I think it's going to be a really exciting time to be an England fan. And some players that are going to open themselves up a little bit more socially to make sure that you guys get the best insight, as well as, you know, keep performing well. Because at the end of the day, we can do all the podcasts, you can do all the inside lines, but we've got to keep playing well, and that we will promise to do, I think.
Yeah, and also picking the best players. I don't know whether you've got an opinion on players like Henry Arundel playing in Racing.
Yeah,
Lewis Ludlum's now off to Toulon.
Apparently,
he's signed for there. You've got Jack Willis over in Toulouse, I think, re-signed to take him out of that. Like, are the conversations within camp, because it is in a weird position at the minute, isn't it? Where if you're in a club, like say you're at Newcastle, I know there's no England players at Newcastle at the minute, or immediately in the squad, but the opportunity to go and make double the money, but you're going to miss out on your England spot. Do you have an opinion as that as a player? You don't have to.
I think firstly, it's player by player basis. I don't think you can compare a Henry Arundel to a Lewis Ludlam move. I don't think you can compare and a Dave Ribbons move and or Joe Marchant.
You've named a couple more. Exactly. It's a lot of players.
And a lot of these guys sign when they're not involved with England. And that's probably where it gets a little bit tricky. And that probably won't happen now for a long time because Steve will hopefully be consistent with what he's doing in that regard in terms of telling players and that you're going to be in my plans and whatever and staying put. But I think the best players, we want the best players playing the Premiership first and foremost. Now, if they want to go to France, I think that's the price you pay by going to France is you rescind your England career. So, but look, I don't think you can judge any player. I think the experience, every person I've known that's gone to play in France says it's an amazing experience. And loved it. And so I don't think you can frown at anyone who's done it. I think it's, if it's not for you, then yeah, fair enough. And if you want to go and do it, then again, fair enough. But yeah, I think it's right that the best players play in the Premiership.
Yeah. Oh, you do think that?
I do.
Yeah.
I think you can only pick players that play in your league. I think otherwise the league loses all its value. From someone who's obviously playing in the league.
So no, mate, that's great. That's a really interesting take on it. Mate, we're outside looking in.
Hopefully with obviously there's rumours about central contracting and stuff. I don't know a thing about that, and I'm sure that will come clear in the coming weeks and months. But that's only going to encourage players to stay around more. And I want to see the Premiership do really well. I think the product's brilliant. I think the competitiveness of the games is crazy, and the upsets are happening. You've got Quinns beating Sale, you've got Bristol beating Gloucester, then you've got Northampton beating Saracens. I think there's like, you could have, all three of those results could be the other way around and you won't be shocked, and I think that's a testament of a good league.
The game's never been better. I'm watching these games, I'm watching you athletes go at it, and the level of skill, talent, athleticism, power, speed is like nothing I've ever seen before.
Yeah, exactly.
And like the people need, I say people, as in the outside, need to start kind of seeing that, respecting that and understanding what you put your bodies through. Yeah. It's absolutely class.
Exactly.
Benno, that was absolutely amazing,
mate.
Thank you. Good luck for the injury. So you're not that far away. It was medial, was it?
Medial meniscus. So hopefully just after Christmas.
And then Saracens and then into Six
Fingers crossed it all goes well. Let's see.
It will. Been class to have you.
Thanks very much. Cheers, mate. Appreciate it.